Welcome to Step Into Magic, your weekly online radio show on how to develop your psychic ability, deepen your spirituality, and find your own true purpose. Presented by acclaimed medical intuitive, Josephine Lang. This broadcast is a part of the Wisdom and Intuition Network. This is Anthony Taylor, your host, and on behalf of Josephine, I'll be taking your calls and questions. This week's topic is, we are all one, meditating our way into the right hemisphere of our brains. For those of you who are new to our show, Josephine has been a clairvoyant healer for more than 25 years. During that time, she's helped thousands of people from around the world to heal from hard-to-diagnose and chronic health issues. She has also been a teacher and spiritual mentor for hundreds of people who treasure her insights, courage, and love.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad you're here. This is a wonderful topic that we're working on this month, which is meditation. And meditation can open us up to the deepest mysteries of our being. When we allow ourselves to access that quieter, stiller part of our minds, we can actually become one with everything and really understand that and know that and know the truth of who we are. It's the illusion of our separation from the divine that causes all of our suffering. And when we open ourselves to meditation, we can really reclaim that connection. And when we enter into that oneness, we find infinite bliss in the timeless moment of now. So this is the source from whence all love flows. But before I go into this topic any further, I always like to begin our show with a spiritual agreement. And this was a gift to us from my friend and spiritual mentor, Jana Massey. And it goes like this, and I ask you all to join in with me, if you would, on this, with this agreement today. Together, we acknowledge that everything that we think, that we say, and that we do at this time will be of the highest good. And together we ask for truth, the understanding of that truth, and the wisdom to use it in our lives. Can you all agree?
I do.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, everyone.
Josephine, we had a lovely message from a listener who wrote in to say, I'm looking forward to the show. And there's a smiley face. Enjoy and God bless your good work, Grace.
Oh,
that's very nice.
Thank you, Grace.
And we also had a wonderful message from Rose about last week's broadcast. Perfect, perfect show. This is my kind of show. You were informative and funny and personal and wow, perfect show. And hearing Carl was so much fun. And the meditations, the palms of my hands had holes in them. They were open. You opened me so I could meditate and open my mind. Thank you so much. Love from Rose.
Oh, isn't that great?
It was wonderful. It was a packed show last week, wasn't it?
It was.
And I know that there was an important exercise that we didn't get to at the end of last week's show. And I just wondered whether perhaps we could start with that tonight.
Oh, certainly. I'd be delighted.
Oh, good.
I think that sounds like a great idea. So before we go into finding oneness through meditating, we'll move for a moment back to guided imagery meditation. And this is one of my very favorite exercises, so I'm so glad you mentioned it, Tony. This is for getting messages from our spirit guide or for asking within. And perhaps you can show that slide there. This was one of the things that my mentor, Jana, used to share with us. And she would say that there is no question that is foolish and all questions are valid. And that a really common and easy question to ask is, do you have a message for me? And so that's one of the phrases that I have really adopted in all sorts of communications. So when I'm communicating with plants or with nature spirits or when I'm out in nature reaching towards the deeper consciousness of our whole human race or whatever it might be, I will often remember this question. So that's what I've titled this exercise today, is do you have a message for me? And one of the things that happened in my experience, I originally got this exercise from Shakti Gawain in her beautiful book, Creative Visualization, which I mentioned last week as well. Excuse me, and it's a lovely, lovely book. And in this, what she suggests and what I like to do is to imagine that a spirit guide comes to greet you. And you might want to picture a beautiful place somewhere where you feel very comfortable. It could be indoors or outdoors. it should be like that Goldilocks principle, you know. There's one that's too big and one that's too small and one that's just right. So you want to find in your mind, in your imagination, a place that's just right for you. And the same thing with the spirit guide. Let just the perfect image of the spirit guide come through for you. And it can be anything. It can be a ball of golden light, or it can be a person, or it can be a horse or an animal, or a person from another part of the world, or any number of things, whatever feels right to you. It could be a plant. It could be the strawberry fairy. It doesn't matter, really. And so whatever feels just right to you is what you can invite to come forward. And just let the deeper part of yourself, the inner knowing of you, just present that to you. So just trust yourself for whatever it is. And interestingly enough, one of the places that I often will go to in my journeying, when I look within and do a little guided imagery meditation like this and ask a spirit guide to come, is often I'll find myself in my mind's eye back in my old horse corral where I grew up, the house that I grew up in. My mom and dad let me build a little corral to the side of the house, and my horse Duchess moved in there for a while with us. And it was so lovely to have her there, and it was just so nice to slip outside any time of day or night and just be in that corral with her and feel her loving warmth and attention. And so a lot of times I'll just go to that place in my mind for these wonderful adventures within. And so you might find something like that in your past, or it could be something that you've imagined too, so it doesn't really too much matter where. You can create something. It could be a beautiful meadow with a waterfall, or who knows what. But I loved that when my dad did some remodeling long after I had moved out of the house, he actually recognized more than I did even at that particular time how important that place was for me, because he was thinking of sort of rearranging the yard and taking out the corral. And before he did, he actually called me up and asked me if that would be all right with me. And I thought that was so sweet and so understanding of him, and it really helped me to recognize it as one of the great sanctuaries of my life, too. So anyway, so now with that, we'll go ahead and start this exercise of Do You Have a Message for Me? So if you would, go ahead and relax and get yourself comfortable and take a couple of easy and gentle breaths. And as always, if you're operating machinery like driving a car, you're going to want to save this exercise for later. And then in your mind, just imagine a beautiful place. This could be out in nature or in a beautiful building somewhere. Wherever it is, just let yourself be perfectly comfortable. And then ask a spirit guide to come to you and take the first thing that pops into your mind. Trust whatever it is. It might be a person walking towards you, or it could be a light that suddenly appeared, or a squirrel up in a tree. And then greet that spirit guide. Say hello. Ask them for their name and introduce yourself. And then go ahead and ask them, do you have a message for me? Remember whatever it is that you receive so that you can journal it later. And then thank your spirit guide. And let them go. And begin to return back to your normal waking consciousness in the room or wherever you might be. Let yourself just move back into yourself. You might want to stretch your body a little bit and open your eyes if you've closed them. And just come on back to your normal waking consciousness right now. Beautiful. Isn't that a lovely exercise?
Oh, I very much enjoyed it, Josephine. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
puts me into a really deep, comfortable, meditative space.
Yes, isn't it great?
Mm.
And I always get such wonderful messages from these exercises. We do have all of the knowledge of the universe within us, and we are a part of that great ocean of the divine. And we have access to a deep inner guidance within. You know, I loved what Lee Carroll, who brings forth that wonderful energy called Chiron, and he said that all scriptures were channeled. And when you think about it, you know, the prophets have gone into caves or sat on certain mountains, and they've received information as if they've received it from a spirit guide. And they are just, those people who brought those scriptures to us just allowed themselves to receive this kind of wisdom, to just open up to and access it. I think it's really true. I think that we all can if we allow ourselves to and if it feels right to us, if it's our job to do, if it's what we would love to do. So we can all embrace that. And it's especially a nice way for us to get our own information about our spirituality, just to really know who we are. Yeah, so with all of that having been said, then now let's go ahead and move on back to our topic of the day, which is finding oneness and connecting with the divine through meditation. And one of the ideas that I've always just loved comes from Aldous Huxley. He was such a great thinker. And my dad had the good fortune of meeting him, actually, and I was much too young to know what was happening at the time, but I just think it's so wonderful that he did have that opportunity. And Aldous Huxley said that our brains are rather like reducer valves. And that's an interesting thought. So what is a reducer valve? Well, let's see. So if you had a water line out at the street, and it's maybe a 4-inch pipe, and it can carry a tremendous amount of water. We've all seen a fire hydrant that has been knocked over or something, and that big geyser goes up into the sky. Well, you wouldn't want that amount of water pressure to come out your kitchen sink, or else it would blow the sink right off the wall. So you have what are known as reducer valves, and they make the diameter of the pipe come down from, say, 4 inches to 3 to 2 to 1 to a half an inch or something that comes out the sink. And you've got plenty of pressure, but it's not so much that it's going to really affect anything too adversely. And the same thing he said was a similar thing was with our brains, where our brains have access to all of the information of the universe, but they're like a reducer valve. They reduce the amount of information coming in to a more manageable level so that we can conduct ourselves as human beings instead of knowing everything all the time. And I think that's a really nice analogy. So then as well, the Vedic texts speak about the collective consciousness. And I remember once seeing a drawing that somebody was describing. It was in one of our local Institute of Noetic Sciences lectures. And they drew a little picture like the bottom of the ocean floor, the seabed. And they showed little bubbles percolating up to the surface of the water. And they said that our collective consciousness is very like that bottom of the ocean and that percolating up from the ground base of our being. We can access all of the information that's available at different times, and even all at once, should we be so open and to choose so. They said that consciousness can be described as an energized field of information, and I thought that was a very wonderful way to look at it, an energized field of information. And then I love that quote by Deepak Chopra. He, comes from the East and has lovely deep thoughts along these lines. And he just says them so easily, they just roll off his tongue. And perhaps you can show the next slide then, because this is Deepak Chopra's quote.
Certainly.
I hope we remember to credit him on the slide. It says, "Consciousness is the ground of existence at the heart of all creation." Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness is the ground of existence at the heart of all creation. So our collective consciousness is all of our individual consciousnesses combined. And this represents the combined souls of any number of people in a group, or all of us, all humanity. And together this collective holds the power to do anything in the universe. And as per the Vedic texts, whatever intention the collective consciousness holds becomes our reality. So this is getting back to that importance of our thoughts and that what we think really, you know, we are creative beings. We were created in the image of the Creator, so therefore we are creative. And one of the things that is thought of in terms of this is that there is a critical mass, that 1% of a population, that is the critical mass. And we've all heard that 100th monkey story. I love that story. It's about there was this troop of monkeys on an island, and there were some scientists who were feeding them yams, and they would just dump out this box of yams on the beach, and all the monkeys would come over, and the yams were, you know, had sand on them, and they would chew them down. And then one monkey one day, I guess one of the yams sort of rolled over close to the stream, and he just thought, you know, I'm just going to wash that off. And he went ahead and washed that off and then ate it, and it wasn't so gritty to eat. And then before you knew it, you know, all of those monkeys on that island went ahead and were washing off their yams. And then that population of monkeys happened to represent 1% of the total population of the monkeys on all the islands in the area of that type of monkey. And then, bingo, instantly, it entered into their morphogenetic field, as Rupert Sheldrake speaks about, although I don't know if he'd like the association with the 100th monkey, but the idea is that it became part of the group knowledge. And so then all of the monkeys began to wash their food before they ate it and had a much more enjoyable meal that way. And I think that's a really interesting thought for us to keep in mind, that our collective consciousness, what we think, you know, this really holds our reality. And this brings me to the thought of this wonderful work by a woman named Sandra Ingerman. And she has a CD called Miracles for the Earth. And what she's come up with is a formula for transmutation. And so it's with great gratitude to Sandra Ingerman that I'd like you to, if you could, Tony, go ahead and put on that next slide now.
Certainly.
And so what she says is that transmutation holds the power to create miracles. That's her basic thought. And first what we want to do is to see the beauty in all things by living in a state of appreciation and gratefulness. Isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
And it's only our perception that really needs to change. And this, of course, is similar to what we hear about in the Course of Miracles, that a miracle is a change in perspective. And so what she has come up with is this formula that's on the slide here. So our intention plus our love plus our union plus our focus plus our harmony plus our concentration and plus our imagination creates transmutation. And that's how we can change forms. We can change things. We can transform them into miracles, basically. And so what Sandra says is she says that the intention, the first part of the formula, fires the brain as if it's already done. So it's like that, planting a seed in the soil. We want to see it as already having happened. Then the love opens up the heart. And then our union with the divine creative force is ever aware and fully in the truth. We want to be, you know, just right in the truth of our divinity. And then from there we go on to focus, which she said that's like the lens of a camera where we can really clearly see the vision that we are working towards. And then with harmony, we create harmony within. When we have harmony within, we create harmony without. So finding that harmony, and that brings balance and alignment to the whole. And this lets us see and honor the beauty within. And in order to see, and that lets us see and honor the beauty without. And then she says that our concentration holds our intention. And she found that toning was a really useful way to help hold the concentration. And what she did with a group of friends was she transmuted water that they had polluted with acid intentionally and with, you know, great love as a part of their experiment. And then they chanted and toned and danced and sang and held all of these principles well in mind for several hours. And they were actually able to significantly change the pH of that water back to normal within a very short period of time. So it's really quite an extraordinary experience. And hear her speak of, and I highly recommend anyone who wants to go ahead and get that CD, Miracles for the Earth. It's just really, really something. And then she said that imagination is also a part of this. And our imagination lays the tracks for the creative energy of reality to follow. And I'm thinking of like a train running ahead of us. You know, if we can imagine those tracks, then our creative energy can really follow it. And then it's good to plant beauty rather than fear with our words. And our enthusiasm mirrors our creative potential. And so that is the basic nutshell of how she really allows that transmutation to come about and shows us just such a wonderful thing about our human potential that we don't really often think about how creative we can be and how our thoughts are so powerful and our intention, opening up from that place of love and that union with the divine force. It's really remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Yeah, I really love that. I think it holds such great hope for us in our future when we really get our act together and start to really think positively. I think we'll be surprised how quickly we can transform our world and our lives. Looking forward to that day myself.
Oh, Josephine, your life has been transformed.
It has been, and it's a beautiful life, and I'm so very, very grateful.
Yes, and I'm very grateful for the impact that you've had on my life.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Really mutually wonderful. You've impacted my life so positively as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. And then, you know, another teacher that I just love is Neil Donald Walsh. And one of the main teachings from the Conversations with God that he had was that we are all one. And this is a teaching that you hear throughout the scriptures. You hear about this oneness, that we are all one. And that's what we're really focusing on today. And Neil goes on to say that this is different from separateness. He says, like for instance, he uses the analogy of the human body. So our baby finger is different from our index finger and from the palm of our hand, but it's not separate. So that's that idea of differentiation versus separateness. And maybe you can show this next slide then.
I have some bad news, Josephine.
What?
That slide is not there.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
We'll just talk about it.
Yes, we'll just talk about it. And this is something that I've heard said, and I really believe it's true, and that is that it is the illusion of our separation from the divine that causes all of our suffering. So I'll say that again because that was our slide there. It is the illusion of our separation from the divine that causes all of our suffering. When we feel that we are not all one with the vast divinity of the universe, then we do really feel that suffering. When we feel that we are separate from God or from the Creator or from the creative source of the universe or from our own divinity, then we do suffer. And when we embrace a life of separation, separate from another, we have loneliness, separate from, you know, this group, separate from that group, we can wind up with war. It can be a psychological imbalance, and it can actually become a pathology. And so this idea of separation is one that we really want to take a look at and realize about this idea of differentiation versus separation and how important that is. And so we do have another slide then that maybe we should go ahead and move on to now.
Certainly.
And we've all heard of spontaneous remission from disease, and what Deepak Chopra talks about in his book Quantum Healing is that it is the one thing that people who have that spontaneous remission from, you know, usually fatal diseases, is that they find a state of bliss. Somehow they enter into that bliss state. And, of course, you remember Joseph Campbell, his wonderful saying that really is sort of the hallmark of his work is follow your bliss. If we can do that, if we can, and the way I like to put it, the way I've kind of found it for my own self is stay in your joy. When we stay in our joy, life really changes for us. We find our way, doors open for us, as Joseph Campbell would say, that wouldn't even be there for anyone else. And our joy is the truest guide for us to really find and know our life, to really be in our purpose. And I often refer to that great triple blessing, which I discovered in my life, which is that our psychic ability and our spirituality and our purpose are all connected. And if we work on one, the other two come along. So if we stay in our joy and we find our purpose in life, then we will be blessed with the spiritual growth that comes with that, along with a sense of knowing that psychic ability, that psychic aspect will come through. Or if we work on developing our psychic ability, our spirituality will naturally come along as a part of that as well, because those are the guards at the gate that keep us safe so that we can really venture into those waters further without any harm. We can move safely into the mystery. And the same with our spirituality. As we really develop and work on our spirituality, we do have those psychic insights, those insights that come, those epiphanies, those understandings of the deeper nature of the world and of the universe and of life itself. And so those come to us as little psychic flashes and hunches. And then, of course, if we're working in our spirituality, we really find our purpose in life. It just sort of comes with it. They all come together. And so that's the great triple blessing. And so this slide says, follow your bliss, is Joseph Campbell, and then the way that I say it is, stay in your joy. Now, as well, Carl Jung, you know, beautiful, wonderful Swedish psychoanalyst, came up with those three divisions. I'm not sure if he was actually the creator of those three divisions, but he speaks of the subconscious mind, the superconscious mind, and the conscious mind as being the three divisions. So the subconscious mind is that which we're not really aware of that's in our consciousness. So that's what's operating our bowels and breathing our lungs and, you know, beating our heart and all of that. Now, of course, we can take some conscious control of that. We can measure the timing of our breath and whatnot. But for the most part, that's all being taken care of by the subconscious mind. And then our superconscious mind is our connection with the divine. A lot of people would think of that eighth chakra above the head, the white light chakra, as being our connection with our higher self. And then our conscious mind is that which sort of is the day-to-day, everyday workings of our lives. And the kahunas, the wise elders and medicine men of the Polynesian tradition, would say that the unification of those three divisions is what really helps us to be hold our focus in life and to really set our goals and accomplish. So we're guided by our higher self, and then we use our conscious mind to make the decisions, and then our subconscious mind, which is the great powerhouse of our being, if that's all on board together, then we have vast creative potential. So some people refer to this these delineations as, I've heard it, well, Peace Pilgrim sometimes talks about it as self-will and God's will. And Peace Pilgrim, you know, is one of my wonderful main mentors. She's perhaps one of the great American saints. She traveled 25,000 miles on foot for peace. And her pilgrimage, she was a pilgrim, and her pilgrimage was a prayer. And she walked until given shelter, and she fasted until giving food, until she was given food. And it was not only a prayer, but it was also a meditation. It was a walking meditation. And she would speak about the lower self and the higher self in her sort of everyday words. And she says that the viewpoints between the two are completely different. And when she first was being inspired, looking and searching for her life before she became a pilgrim, she went out walking all night one night with that intention to seek and to find what meaning in her life. And she came upon a moonlight clearing, and there she was just inspired to suddenly say, out loud, you know, if you can use me for anything, please use me. And she refers to this as like the first spiritual hump, when she gave herself a total dedication of her life to divine will, to give herself over to that higher self, to that that God self within that we all have. And so perhaps you can show that slide then, Tony.
Certainly.
The slide says, if you can use me for anything, please use me. And I think that a lot of us have come to this point in our lives. There comes a time sometimes where we have to let go, and we have to give up and give it over to the divine will.
And it's a very scary thing to do, though, isn't it, Josephine?
Yes, it is. It's a very scary thing.
Because, I mean, you don't know what the answer might be.
Right. But here comes, you know, radical trust.
Yes, I mean, it is a real leap of faith, isn't it?
It is. And
but whatever it is, you'll be okay.
Yeah. And with radical trust, in comes magic, the beautiful magic like I have. You know, that's why I call my radio show Step Into Magic. This is where we give ourselves over and we just find ourselves just flying into beautiful lives that are so full and so rich with spirituality and purpose and psychic insight and creativity. And it's just remarkable. But this is sort of that one of those first steps, as Peace Pilgrim refers to it, the first spiritual hump. And she felt that when she said that night, that with that she found what she was looking for. And then she said there was a number of years where the personal struggle between that higher self and the lower self, or the self-will and God's will, or, you know, that was sort of what came in then to help. And she had that personal struggle with those two aspects of herself before she came into harmony. And when she speaks about having come into harmony, that's where she has come into harmony with divine will, where she has really fully given herself over. And in the midst of that struggle, you know, she that's where she caught her first glimpse of harmony, and then she made further progress into it. And I have a tape recording that comes from Friends of Peace Pilgrim, and in it, it was a talk that she gave in San Jacinto, California in 1962. And she was just 7 years into her pilgrimage then, and she, you know, walked from 1955 till, I believe it was 1981. And she said, and I'll just quote her here, she said, "Now this is a very significant experience. Some religious groups call it illumination." And then she found that she could return again and again into the life of harmony and could stay there for longer and longer periods of time. And then she realized that when she had slipped out of harmony, she would really miss harmony. Until finally she was able to stay there all the time. She said that finally she had succeeded in giving her life. She had gotten over that second spiritual hump. And then she said, again, this is the point of no return. You have to go on from there. And so she said that she went into the life of inner peace, and she has been in that life at the time she gave this talk for 7 years then. And, of course, after you've found inner peace, she says, there's no more instructions need be given. You will know your way from within. And she said, "If I tried to describe inner peace to you in my everyday words, I would say that it's a feeling of being surrounded by all of the good things." She said, "I feel primarily love and peace and joy as a protective surrounding. And that joy is very definitely a part of it, because who could know God and not be joyous? And that knowing God is a part of inner peace, and that there is a constant awareness of the presence of God, a constant communion." And she said, "Look at what this does to your life. In the presence of God, there can be no more fear. Everything negative is gone. There is a constant unshakableness within, which takes you through any situation that you may have to face." And she said, "To the world, you may seem to be facing tremendous obstacles, but there are always the inner resources to easily overcome the obstacles, and nothing seems difficult." She said, "There is a calmness and a serenity and an unhurriedness, and that life is full and good, but never overcrowded." And she went on to say that everything you need is provided, even the thoughts to think and the words to speak. Isn't that remarkable?
Yes, that's truly wonderful. That really is speaks of such a deep trust, what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, you know, it can be so difficult to ask that question because of lack of trust. But what I hear in those words is someone who trusts completely.
Yes, absolutely. And there she was, walking until she was, you know, given shelter, and fasting until she was given food. And she said that she might go one or two nights sometimes sleeping by the side of the road, or perhaps she might, you know, slip into a parked car and sleep the night there, but or an all-night gas station or something. But she said for the most part, most of the time she had a good bed to sleep in, people would offer. And then she said she never went very long without food, and she said she never even thought of food until it was offered. And she said the most she ever went was about 4 meals without food. And people would just offer, "Oh, would you like some?" And then she did speaking engagements. She would speak at universities and colleges. And all she carried, she just wore her simple tunic of pants and a shirt and a little tunic that said on the front, you know, "Peace Pilgrim," and on the back it said, "Walking 27,000 miles on foot for peace." And she said that it was wonderful. She didn't have to approach anybody. People are curious, and they would approach her, and they would ask her questions. And all she carried with her was a comb and a pen so that she could write letters and some stamps. She carried no money. She didn't need any money. She got herself down to what she called was need level. And she said that, you know, she wanted to reduce her life to that level because she found that she didn't feel comfortable having more than she needed when there were so many people that had less than what they needed. And so she just got herself down to need level and hit the road and went on a mission for peace and did so much good, really created good ideas and thought-provoking discussions about peace wherever she went. It's really something.
Truly inspiring.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, no wonder you admire her and look up to her so much.
Yeah, I really do.
Mm.
And she uses the term God, and I know that in some circles that's a little uncomfortable for some people. And these days there's been so many difficulties associated with religion. So I usually like to think of that as love or as this universal consciousness that we share, mm-hmm. although I don't have any problems with the word myself really anymore. There was a time when I did because it was lacking the feminine gender, but mm-hmm. I've sort of gotten over that.
Yeah, I'm similar. I grew up, you know, and it was very much the idea in my upbringing that God was this man up there somewhere,
vengeful,
ruling over everything.
Yeah,
and you know, and so it's hard to let go of that connotation when you hear the word. But I think in recent years, it's almost completely disappeared for me now.
Yeah, and that older version too also carries with it that problem of separation. Because God is apart and separate and maybe up on a cloud or something, you know?
Yeah, very much so. The idea that, you know, God is there and you're here. That was part of the God that I was instructed in as a child.
Yeah.
And now, I guess, I don't see that at all.
I see,
you know, we're all divine.
All part of the one. Our single little unique drop in the ocean
mm-hmm.
of water. But we carry that signature within us and we have access to that
mm-hmm.
aspect of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a much happier, more joyous way of experiencing and thinking about it.
Yeah, me too. So there was a wonderful TED Talk that I saw some years ago that I really like to encourage everybody to see if they can. It's called A Stroke of Insight, and it's by a woman named Jill Bolte Taylor. And Jill was a brain scientist. She had a brother who had a serious brain condition, and so as she grew up, she decided she wanted to be a brain scientist, and so she studied the brain. And then one day, before going to work, as she was going through her morning routine, she experienced a stroke in the left hemisphere of her brain. She had a blood vessel that burst, and she was going through her normal routine, and she kind of had a flash of a headache, and that hurt. And then she, as a brain scientist, you know, and because of her lifetime of observation with science, from a you know, really scientific perspective, she was able to notice that gradual shutting down of the function of the left hemisphere of her brain. And so when she would slip more into her right brain use, as the left brain was shutting down, she would kind of go into that right brain space, and then her left brain would come back on board again for a few minutes and say, wait a minute, Houston, we've got a problem, and let's do something. That's her analytical mind on the left brain. And so she, you know, would kind of go into that panic when the left brain would come online, and then into that bliss state when the right brain was online, because our brains are both very different in their function. And she was able to witness it from that more esoteric perspective also, which is the right brain perspective, which is free of all past emotional associations, because our emotional associations are held in the left brain. And so she was more like the observer. And she described, you know, trying to dial in to work to say, I don't feel well, I think something's happening, and, you know, trying to look at the keypad on the telephone, and she had to get out her business card to see, you know, which numbers were, because she couldn't really remember. She was going off of the symbols rather than the numbers of what say, a 5 looked like and a 4 looked like, and trying to find them. And she did manage to go ahead and make the call into work, and that's how, you know, and she said that when a coworker picked up the phone, he sounded like a Labrador retriever. He was because language is also in the left brain, and she heard herself say to him, "Woof woof woof." And you know, she meanwhile kept feeling this extensive influx of sensory perception, because that is right brain, and this awareness of colors and smells and tastes. And she said she was increasingly becoming an energy being connected to everything in the here and now, which was perfect and whole and beautiful. And then she would switch back into her left brain and become, you know, aware of, oh my gosh, we got a problem. And then she'd go back into the right brain and become one with everything again and interconnected in that state of peaceful euphoria. And she wanted to share this information with the world. It was part of why she worked so hard to heal herself and come fully back to her full left and right brain function, which she did. Because she said, you know, here is the solution to our problems right inside of our heads in the right brain, so far as finding nirvana and finding that interconnectedness and letting go of that separation mentality. And so there's this beautiful part of our brains. It's in between the left and the right hemisphere, and it's called the corpus callosum. And the corpus callosum is that part that lets us really connect the two halves, the two hemispheres together. It lets us, you know, be able to hold paper and cut it with a scissors, or come up with a creative solution and speak about it. It, you know, using both hemispheres of the brain at the same time. And so those left brain processes, the left brain handles situations that are familiar. It thinks about the past and the future. It holds the details of the present moment. And it's a real organizer, and it interrelates everything that's in the present moment with all of our past experiences. And then our left brain is also responsible for numerical computation and language. And the numerical computation, I kind of wonder what happened with my left brain. It's not as good as it could be, but it's fine. I love it. And then it's that mind chatter is also a part of our left brain function, that constantly reminding us of what to do and when and, you know, what's happening. And so when we find ourselves writing lists and thinking of those kind of things, that's our left brain that's helping us out. It also likes to use very conventional approaches to problem solving, and it has very well-rehearsed responses, and it's analytical, and it, you know, very precisely interprets information. And and then it also is the holder of years of, you know, emotional baggage. And then as well, different from that is our right brain. And our right brain comes up with solutions to novel challenges. It has, you know, very creative and new ways of doing things. It's all about inspiration and creativity, and it's very much in the present moment. Not how it relates to the past, but just the right now, that eternal now. And our right brain is also responsible for helping us to move safely through space and facial recognition, and it's that quiet mind that we all seek in meditation. And it's really also the source of our psychic perception, and it has all of those wonderful, insightful solutions and limitless possibilities, and it's the observer. And then, like Jill was saying, it's that, you know, perfect, whole, and beautiful, connected to everything state of euphoria that we can access. And this is what we try to do in our meditation. We try to really allow ourselves to move into our right brain, where's that, you know, that open innocence lies and that rich sense of abundance. So it's really a remarkable aspect of ourselves, and it's right inside of our heads.
So would you say that children are more like right brain oriented?
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. We have a very left brain dominant cultural way of teaching our children. So our children become much more left brain as time goes on. You know, that game of pretend and play and being in the moment and just sitting and being who we are. Those are all wonderful right brain functions that you find children doing a lot of. And also animals. So our dogs and cats, you know, mammals, they are just as varied as people. Anybody who's spent any time around a barnyard or has had pets knows that, you know, every pig is different and every chicken has a personality, and they're very capable of reflection and analyzing life. They definitely have left brains as well, but they're much more youthful and frolicsome. They definitely have a stronger participation in the right brain. They don't have that sort of favoritism for the left brain or a dominance for the left brain in their belief systems and in the way that they conduct themselves. And so one of the little sayings that I've come across is, seeking enlightenment, lighten up. You know, and I think that that's what we find in children and in animals and in those of us who have really worked on finding our right brain and owning it and developing it. And that helps us to come to that present moment where we can be happy and peaceful and go with the flow and be joyous and all of that all at once, you know, with a lot of enthusiasm to boot.
Mm.
And you know, I like to think, I love that little saying that I came across somewhere, that the word dog, spelled backwards, is God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something to that. Light, happy, loving, unconditional acceptance that dogs have that is not too unlike what the divine can be, you know, if we think of it that way. And so, you know, why not quiet our minds in meditation and open our hearts to that infinite bliss and the timeless moment of now? That's what we can do when we step into the right brain.
Wow. Sounds absolutely wonderful, Josephine. We do actually have a caller on the line.
Oh, lovely.
Okay, I'll put her.
Oh, very nice.
Put her through.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Oh, hi, this is Barbara.
Oh, Barbara.
Hi.
Oh,
well,
cute.
Yes.
Oh,
Being a friend of yours, of course, I have a right brain. I tend to have developed my right brain more. And would you speak about neuroplasticity and about how there's like, from what I understand, there's more promise for being able to have some effect on the development of the different sides of our brain. But what I'm wondering is, would it be more beneficial to develop the, did you call that the corpus? What was the middle part?
Corpus callosum, yes.
What we want is balance. What we want is balance, always.
Yes, we do.
And balance, harmony, so I'm wondering, what do you think about neuroplasticity, and how would you go about developing that part of your brain rather than go to luminosity and play games and develop your left brain more, or do you think that is a good solution for some people? So I'll hang out and listen to the answer.
Okay, beautiful question, Barbara. Thank you so much for calling. And yes, so I love neuroplasticity. You know, for the longest time, it was believed that you cannot heal a brain, that once a brain is injured, it's done for, that's it. But really, we've found now that we can grow new brain cells. We can really develop our brain. And Bruce Lipton has done a lot of wonderful work in this topic of epigenetics, and he has a beautiful book called The Biology of Belief, and it talks about whatever we believe we can really influence and grow more of that part of our brain. So if we believe that everything is terrible, then we sort of focus on that, and that's more of what we create in our lives. If we believe that everything is beautiful, we focus on that, and that's more of what we create in our lives. And in regards to neuroplasticity, that is the idea that we can change our brains. We can actually change the way that our brains think and act and behave. And one of the things that really helps us with neuroplasticity is learning new things. And so if you've never played tennis before, you go out and you learn how to play tennis and or pick up the violin or something like that. For myself, I've been having great bursts in neuroplasticity in the last couple of years because I've gone from being a techno spaz and a techno resistor and a techno phobe to being, somewhat of a slight computer whiz. And so that's an example of neuroplasticity, really taking on something that you're not familiar with, of how to develop neuroplasticity, really taking on something that you're not familiar with and just diving into the deep end. And so that's one of the ways. And then, of course, taking care of our brains nutritionally. So high blood sugars are one of the things that's known to really harm our brains. And so keeping those blood sugars low by eating natural foods from, a wholesome diet fresh from the garden is the best way that I like to describe that. And being sure to have healthy fats. For a long time we had that, no-fat diet thing, which was kind of the craze. And now we're sort of in the craze of no carbs. Well, I believe that foods from the table that we would have seen, in our great-great-grandmother's kitchen are pretty much going to be all just fine for us. So that's going to be fresh stuff from the garden and some of the things that, maybe they have preserved and natural roots and tubers and whole grains and very little meat because meat was always at a premium in every culture around the world, very, very little of that. Maybe some fresh fish if you happen to be one of the ocean-dwelling cultures. Being really gentle with that aspect of ourselves, of being careful with our diet and eating a wholesome, nutritious diet. In other words, nothing that comes in a package or in plastic. You pretty much shop in the produce section, or better yet, grow your own in your own garden, because some of these new varieties are so rich in sugars and have great shelf lives, and so they've got more a higher glycemic index and higher blood sugar effect on our blood sugars. So, the old heirloom tomatoes and heirloom apples and heirloom potatoes and whole foods that are natural is a great way for us to really keep our brains in good health as well as the rest of our bodies. And then exercise, that is a wonderful thing for our brains. And so that's how we really enhance our neuroplasticity. And then really thinking good thoughts, like I was saying about what Bruce Lipton talks about with his epigenetics. And epigenetics is the ability to change our gene expression. And so that is how, you know, our genes are, we used to think that our genes sort of determined who we are and that it was concrete and set in stone. Now we realize that it's more like we can unveil or reveal different genes. And so depending on our habits in the world, you know, our diet style and our lifestyle, that can have an effect on our genetics. And so similarly, how we are treating our brain can have an effect on how our brain grows. And so, like you said, you know, focusing on luminosity or getting playful, that would be great for somebody who spends a lot of time in a really analytical space. And then similarly, somebody who's constantly, you know, too playful and having too great of a time, they might want to spend some time learning the computer. So it's all, like you said, Barbara, so beautifully, it's all about balance and harmony. So, you know, to develop our neuroplasticity, what we want to do is to go into the areas where we are not strong and make those be stronger in our lives. And thereby we find our balance and our harmony.
So is it more about, you know, having the two working in harmony, as you say, together,
yes,
rather than just developing each separately?
Yes.
Trying to get them to come together.
Yeah, but the way that we do that is through making sure that they're both strong.
Mm-hmm.
So we might have to develop one separately,
mm-hmm,
for a while in order to give it an equal strength. Because, as I said, we're kind of left brain dominant in our culture. Not kind of. We are.
That's definitely true.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you very much, Barbara, for that great question.
Yeah, she's not there now, Josephine,
mm-hmm,
because
okay,
I thought she was just leaving after asking the question.
Yes, yes. All right. So now I'd like to just go a little bit into the idea of the atom, and then we'll just try to squeeze in one more exercise if we can, Tony.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So, you know, we know about atomic science. So that's the study of the atom. So the atom, if we blew up an atom to the size of a mountain, there would be the nucleus would be about the size of an orange, pretty small, in other words, and there might be 10 or 11 electrons about the size of cherries whizzing around. And that's what makes up an atom. An atom, in other words, is mostly empty space, mostly clear space. And there's just those little tiny bits of particles that have a tendency to appear from time to time. And it also depends on the observer. That's a whole other story. I mean, if the observer believes that there are particles, then they will show up as particles. Or if the observer believes that they are waves, then they'll show up as waves. So, but that's an aside. So this one woman that I met and studied with briefly, a wonderful woman named Judith Blackstone, she wrote a book called The Subtle Self in Motion. And she spoke about the fundamental consciousness and the clear space. And that idea really captivated my imagination and is part of how I feel like I do my work as a medical intuitive. I allow myself to just move on that clear space from the clear space that's inside of myself to the clear space that's outside of myself and then around the world to wherever the clear space inside of another person is, and I try that on and feel what that clear space feels like. And so that's one of those wonderful things that we can kind of play with. And so I'd like to give that to you all as a homework assignment this week, if you feel inclined, to just imagine that you can feel the clear space inside of yourself and what the quality of that clear space feels like. And then then allow yourself to travel on your imagination to the clear space that's outside of yourself, that's in the air around you, or in the chair that you're sitting on, because the chair, made up of atoms, is also largely clear space. And just feel what the quality of that clear space might be like inside of that chair. And this helps us with our empathy, with our ability to sense what other people might be feeling, and it helps us to really understand more that we are all one, because we do all share that same clear space. And though we may have different feelings and moods and things going on inside of that clear space because of our left brain proclivity, we can also enter into that state of oneness and interconnectedness that we have available to all of us all the time in our right brains. So that's just a little meditation exercise for you to do.
Yeah, I've already kind of started to begin to do that, Joseph, as you were just talking about it. And it's very strange when you start imagining that your body is mainly sort of empty space. For me, it makes it feel more like an energy field,
yes,
rather than, you know, flesh and bones.
Yes.
You know, more like a hologram or something.
Yes.
Know, and then I start thinking, well, the desk, that's got a different quality. It's kind of like, it's a little denser. It's kind of like,
yes,
an energy, but it's not the same.
Right.
Mm.
Isn't that remarkable?
Well, I'm certainly going to have some fun with this,
yes,
over the next week.
Oh, good. And, you know, Deepak Chopra talks about the superstition of materiality. In other words, that the materiality, the material world is really just a superstition that we've all entered into. It's a belief system. And, you know, I love that story about Albert Einstein. He used to hit a tennis ball against the chalkboard and the front wall of the room near where the chalkboard was when he was teaching his classes. And one day one of the students said, you know, Dr. Einstein, why is it that you hit that tennis ball against the wall every time before we have our class? And he said, well, because one of these days it's going to go right through.
Yes, very good.
Because he understood about the clear space of atomic science and the superstition of materiality. All right, well, now I'll just try to squeeze in that last little exercise if I can. Do you think, or should I wait and let it
wait? Which one is it?
It's the many faces of God exercise.
Well, then you better.
All right.
After all that talk about God.
Okay, here we go. So if you could put on that slide 10, then, which says, divine glance is winking out from everything. And then also a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which says, see God in all and all in God. And so this exercise, what I like to do, and we'll just do this as a little meditation, is to realize that divinity is everywhere. And this is a right brain idea. This is that coming really into knowing that, you know, a rose or a baby or your beloved or a table or a Kleenex box is all imbued with divinity. You know, the table could have been crafted by, well, it was once a tree and it was crafted by somebody who put a lot of love into creating it or whatever it might be. Even the sidewalk is part of the divine that we walk down every day when we go out and about. My feeling is that there really is no evil, that it's all just ignorance. It's all just something that we're trying to get back to the divine, and that's a bigger topic, so I'll go into that more at another time. But I feel that we're just yearning to return to that connection. It's like if we've had that separation, we go into suffering, and that may have happened through whatever reason, childhood or whatever happened, you know, and we find ourselves separated from the whole, and then we just strive to get back to it. So instead, there's that Zen idea of be with what is, and then Byron Katie with her wonderful book, Loving What Is. We can let it be. We can let whatever it is, we can be with it. And so that divinity may show itself to us in something that might even be kind of scary. I remember once I was doing this exercise as a meditation, and I saw a ship going down, and, you know, the turmoil that happened with all of that and crashing against the rocks on an island. And it's all a part of it, and so we just want to love it all. And this is where we come into that divine glance, winking out at everything. And that, you know, main Hindu scripture from the Bhagavad Gita of see God in all and all in God. So let's just go ahead and take a moment now and just take a couple of relaxed and easy breaths. And then just ask yourself, the way I like to do this is just to say, you know, divine, please present yourself to me in one of all of your many guises. And then just see what comes to you. It could be a rose or a sunflower or a dog or any number of things. And then just thank that image for arising. Thank divinity for presenting that to you. And then just return to your normal waking consciousness. And this, go ahead and stretch and take a couple of breaths. And this is an exercise that, as you just saw, it can be as quick as, you know, 20 seconds. Or you can take a longer time and really sit with it and allow it to really, really soak into it. And maybe you'll see several images. And this is one of those exercises that I like to give to my students and ask them to do it for about 6 months every day if they can. It's a really nice way to really open yourself to oneness through meditation, to really allow yourself to see the divinity in everything and in yourself. If we allow it to present itself in all of its many guises, as I love that beautiful line from Mother Teresa when she said, oh, you know, with all of the poverty in India and everything, she would just say, oh, this is just my beloved divine presenting himself to me in all of his many disguises. I thought that was so beautiful, and that's really what this exercise is about. It's about letting divinity present itself to you in all of its many guises. So with that, Tony, I'll turn it over to you, and I know we're really pressing the clock today.
Dearie me, we are. So let me say that the link to next week's show can be found on Josephine's website at stepintomagic.com. Simply click on the top menu for radio. And if you have a question for us or would like to be included in our weekly newsletter, simply go to the contact page on Josephine's website and send us a message. So, Josephine, any final words you'd like to share?
Oh, yes. Thank you so very much for that, Tony. And I've heard it said that prayer is how we ask and meditation is how we listen to the divine. And as we allow ourselves to become more and more comfortable with dwelling in the right side of our brains, which can be accomplished through the practice of meditation, then we become more able to realize our interconnectivity with everything else. And we also lose all feelings of separation from the divine and realize our own oneness with divinity as our own little part of the divine. As Rumi said, "Behold the body born of dust, how perfect it has become. Why should you ever fear its end? When were you ever made less by dying? When you pass beyond this human form, no doubt you will become an angel and soar through the heavens. But don't stop there. Even heavenly bodies grow old. Pass again from the heavenly realm and plunge into the ocean of consciousness. Let the drop of water that is you become 100 mighty seas. But do not think that the drop alone becomes the ocean, for the ocean too becomes the drop." So in closing, I'd like to thank all of you so very much for giving me the gift of your time. And I'd like to finish with this little blessing. As our gifts are given in love, they are received in love. And we honor their wise use and their increase for all concerned.
Thank you so much for that, Josephine. As always, it's been a real pleasure talking with you on the radio this evening, and I trust that everyone listening has learned lots about meditation and oneness. This has been show number M-4.14. And if you have enjoyed the show, we really hope that you will tell your friends. We look forward to having all of you join us next week when Josephine will be talking about how the three different types of prayer can be used to transform our lives.
Thank you, Tony. And yes, thank you to Frank for all of the beautiful slides tonight as well. And with that, I'll just say that Tony and I wish you all insight, wisdom, and magic as you pursue the journey of inner knowing, and I hold you all in light and in love. Thank you so much for listening. This is Josephine Lang. Until next week, good night.
The moderator has left the conference.